Need a mortgage, but your finances don't fit into a neat little box? Privlo, P-R-I-V-L-O, a new kind of mortgage lender takes a holistic view of your finances to see if you qualify, even if you have a one-time credit blemish. Apply at privlo.com/podcast and fill out a simple online form. You'll have a decision in hours. That's privlo.com/podcast. Or call 855-477-4850. Privlo, get home. Hey, everybody. I want to remind you of a great way that you can help support the show and Earwolf at the same time. And that's through Amazon. You know Amazon. You love Amazon. The next time you want to shop at Amazon, which is probably right now or later, don't go to Amazon.com. That's for losers. Instead, go to Earwolf.com/Amazon. That'll take you to the same Amazon you know and love, and all the prices will be the same great Amazon.com prices that you know and love. But we'll get a sweet, sweet kickback too. Welcome to The Wolf Den, the podcast about the business and future of podcasting and digital media. I'm your host, Midroll Media CEO, Adam Sachs. I'm very happy to say that my guest today is Dan Carlin. Dan is the host and producer of two of the most popular podcasts in the history of the medium, Common Sense and Hardcore History. Common Sense with Dan Carlin is his take on current affairs and politics from his independent Martian, as he calls it, viewpoint. The show has been in production for 288 episodes at the time of this taping. He has produced Hardcore History since 2006, tackling topics like the League of Nations, the collapse of the Bronze Age, and most recently, World War I. Episodes of Hardcore History are known for being comprehensive and often lengthy, running anywhere from 90 minutes to 4 hours. Not surprisingly, they are released typically only 3 to 4 times a year. iTunes named Hardcore History the best classic podcast in 2014. Please welcome Dan. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Did I get that bio right?
You did. The only thing I would say is I do have a partner. You're not supposed to mention who does the production, but I doubt he will care that you didn't mention it.
Is this Ben, your partner?
Maybe.
Okay. You don't have to say. I won't say that Cody's sitting here next to me. I'm really happy to have you. I wanted to just, as a starter question, just get into your background a little bit. You know, I know that you worked as a journalist in TV news and then in radio, and ultimately you became a podcaster. So, like, how did that transition happen?
I was on the radio back in, this was probably 1995. And as you know, radio tends to be formatted so that people who like the station would listen from 8 a.m. till 9 p.m. and have something that appealed to them the entire day. It's not normal to mix up the programming that much. Mm-hmm. And so at the stations that I was at, talk radio is mostly a conservative genre. And so you'd have these conservative syndicated talk radio programs before me and after me. And then all of a sudden this Martian in the day part would arrive. And so it was often me against my audience in 1994, 1995. I must have done something right because I kept the job, but it was an interesting relationship I had. And I remember doing a show one day asking what the audience was willing to do to foster positive change. And I got off the air, you know, sweating and angry and screaming and whatever it was back then. I had a lot more energy back then. And there was a phone call waiting for me, and someone had just left me a message at the front desk saying, if you want to know what I'll do for positive change, call me. And so I called this guy. We ended up meeting in a restaurant. He showed up. He looked like Dilbert, but with hair down to his waist. And it turned out he was a computer genius, really, far ahead of his time in most every way. And he wanted to put me on the internet. But this is a time before there were – I mean, my question was, how do you put me on the internet?
This was like 95?
And that became the first time anybody had said, let's get you out of transmitter range and put you – and make you global.
Was anybody doing that then?
That became the beginning of a process that eventually, once technology caught up, I had been thoroughly briefed and had been talking about this for some time because of someone else's idea.
So at the time, in 1995, was anybody doing a radio show on the internet?
No. And as a matter of fact, I said to this guy, why are you doing this? And he said, I'm going to tie it into software development. I'm going to develop the means to do this, and you're going to be my example. Not so much a guinea pig as the demonstration model, you know? So he would combine the fact that he thought more people should hear my politics, my Martian politics. He was a bit of a Martian too. And at the same time, he could then develop this software which would help his business. So the two ideas dovetailed for him.
Have you considered yourself a Martian since then? Is that where this idea of the Martian came from?
You know, my problem is I'm so jealous of people who can define their political beliefs in a short, concise way. And I can't. And so I said Martian to differentiate myself from other people and to basically say, listen, I know I'm different than most of you, maybe all of you, and I think that's okay, and hopefully you think that's okay. And so Martian became a wonderful way for people to understand, okay, Dan really doesn't fit into any boxes, but he's okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Have you kept in touch with this long-haired Dilbert guy?
Not lately, but I was just saying the other day that I bet people would enjoy hearing us have conversations as part of the podcast, because he's a fascinating guy in his own right.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he really had vision for what was going to happen in audio. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, he's almost one of those people that is a cautionary tale about being too far ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. He was writing apps for the precursor to all the Apple devices. Now, he was writing apps for the Newton and saying this was going to be the latest craze and everything. Well, of course, he was too far ahead of his time, and he moved on to the next thing before apps for things like iPods and iPads became normal. And obviously was ahead of the game on podcasting too, a little too far ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So back to you, you know, I would imagine that most of the listeners of my show certainly know who you are and probably have listened to your show. But for those who haven't, how would you describe what you do? How would you describe your show or your shows?
That's a good question. The Common Sense Podcast is something that is obviously a derivative of what I used to do on the radio. Podcasting is so great because it allows so much intense freedom. I don't have to deal with consultants. I used to have real problems getting along with station management because, you know, they'd say something like, talk about the latest TV shows out there. And I not only can I not do that, I could not fake an interest in doing that and didn't. But it made for a difficult work environment. The podcast allows me the total freedom to do anything I want. And so with the current events and political show, you're basically getting my take on whatever I want to talk about that day. And with the history show, we do something that I don't think has ever been done anywhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's a good thing, but it's nothing I ever could have done in radio.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And I mean, that leads to the – so that's – is that why you, you know, picked the podcast format, is that you started with this desire to tell stories and you felt like that was the medium that would allow you to do it best?
Actually, no. I started a company with several other founders several years ago. I mean, this is probably 1997 or something like that, that was going to be a company that focused on user-generated content long before there was YouTube and stuff like that. And like so many people during that era, the goal was to build something and then sell it, you know? Mm-hmm. That companies were being snapped up left and right, and we thought, you know what, we'll build a company designed for grabbing audience with content that's amateur or non-professional. And once again, I was going to be the guy who was the signature demonstration model, if you will. and then the first bunch of Common Sense episodes, I want to say 30 or 40 or something like that, were done when I was a part of that company that I started with these other guys. And so when that company and I parted ways, I took my show with me.
And why did you pick, you know, so your format is, it's pretty unique in podcasting in the sense that it's basically a lecture or a monologue with, you know, without guests, without segments, without a lot of heavy production. Why did you go that way?
Well, you know, I used to say that the two things that I did best in talk radio were the monologues that we used to use to kick off the show. So maybe the first 15 minutes of one of the radio shows would be me doing a sort of a setup monologue, and usually I could do that pretty well. And so that was what we thought we could capitalize with the podcast. The other thing is, and this is brutally honest, is that I was a pretty good talk radio show 2 days of the week. But of course, I was doing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, which meant that the other days of the week weren't always that great. It was one of those things where, and another talk radio show host said this to me, he said, you know, it's really something that depends on what side of the bed you woke up on that morning. And not every morning was a morning you felt like talking. What's wonderful about the podcast is you can record it on the days when you wake up and say, hey, I'm actually in the mood to talk today. I'm feeling like I have a lot of energy. I have something to say. Let's record a show today. And so I'm able to take my strengths from talk radio and apply them in a way I couldn't when I had to be there, you know, sick, healthy, talkative, not talkative, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
It's funny that you say that, because I wanted to ask you, I wanted to understand why your release schedule isn't as regular as other shows. And it sounds like it's based on mood and when you're feeling ready to perform.
You know, and the funny thing about that, and I cannot claim that we planned this at all, but I feel like it's been a real positive byproduct, is that it's better, in my opinion, to release too little rather than too much. And I often see, you know, I pay attention to other podcasts out there, and I read, you know, their audience comments, and I try to pay attention to what they're doing. And it's amazing how often I'll read audience members saying, yes, I'm behind on the shows, or I can't keep up, or I stopped listening daily after a while because they're getting essentially too much content.
Right.
And while I certainly don't think we put out enough or as much as I'd like to, I do feel like when we put something out, it is snapped up quickly and enjoyed, as opposed to people saying, oh, I haven't gotten around to Dan's latest show or something like that. And so I didn't plan it that way, but I think it's sort of worked to our advantage, sort of the less is more kind of
approach. Absolutely. I mean, people are – I think it's like you hit them at a point when they're starving for more of your content, and it's this nourishment that they get every time you release an episode. Do you give people a heads up, like, hey guys, new episode coming out in 2 weeks, or is it a surprise?
No, because I don't know the answer to that. And I would just, if I did that, they would be angry with me when I promised something in 2 weeks and then didn't deliver.
Yeah.
Especially with the history show, by the time we're getting ready to release one of those, it's a little like college final exam time. I mean, there's pizza boxes all over the floor, and, you know, old coffee cups everywhere, and we're one step away from going insane. And so, I mean, we never really quite know. And when it's done, you know, like Churchill said, we just fling it to the public and let the chips fall where they may, and then sleep for like five straight days.
So that history show is hardcore history, perennially a top, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 show in iTunes, and famously long, running anywhere from 90 minutes all the way to, I know there was an epic 4.5 hour.
5.5 hours.
Oh, 5.5 hours. Was that Blueprint for Armageddon 5?
No, that was the last show we did in the Roman series.
Okay.
And I want to say, you know, the first one we ever did was, I think, 20 minutes long, and that's what I thought we were going to do. So it shows you that, you know, once you create something, sometimes its evolution is only partly in your hands.
Right. And so why do a 5.5 hour episode versus breaking that into seven episodes or 10 episodes?
Well, the idea was to get it done, because if you're only going to put 10 or 15 shows in your feed, and then they're all on the same subject, if you have 5 or 6 episodes all on Rome, which mm-hmm. was the case in this situation, then when new listeners find you, if they're not interested in Rome, they don't have a lot of choices on your feed.
Yeah.
And so I had, and I'm famous at predicting that these things are going to take a lot less time than they will. I mean, the whole goal of the Roman show was to do a show on Cleopatra, because I felt like we hadn't done enough on women. And so we sat down and tried to figure out, well, where do you have to start a Cleopatra story for it to make sense? And, well, you have to have Julius Caesar, because he's involved with her. And then you think, well, Julius Caesar doesn't make any sense unless you go to this. And you start following the dominoes backward. And, oh, my gosh, all of a sudden you realize that you have to cover 150 years of history for any of it to make sense. And so, long story short, we never even got to Cleopatra. And it was six shows and like 18 hours of content or whatever the heck it turned out to be. And people tell me all the time, my wife says to me, why can't you just cut down on the detail and make these shows shorter so that they're not so trying on you? And I it's funny, but you can't really, I can't really go backwards. You can't say that the audience members who like the detail that you put in the current shows now have to live with a much shallower, might not be the right word, but less intense version of the program than they're used to. That's what I mean about you only having minimal control after a while over how things evolve. Even if I didn't want to do the kind of programs we do now, if I changed it, I think a lot of people would be angry.
Truthfully,
I've set a standard that I try to keep up myself, so I don't think I'd be satisfied anymore.
So what if you kept the amount of detail, kept the length, but you just inserted, you know, artificial breaks after an hour? You said, all right, we're going to take a break and, you know, next week or tomorrow we're going to release the next part.
Well, but take that Roman series that we did, the six-part Roman series as an example. That would be a 30-part series.
Right.
You know, and again, talk about your feed being cluttered up with a single topic sort of thing. I mean, every free show that we have online would be about Rome.
That's true.
You know, I mean, so that's our and then you get desperate. I feel the same way about the First World War series we're doing now. I told my audience that it ends with this episode we're working on now, part six, even if it has to be 5.5 hours long.
Wow.
We're going to finish it.
And I know that you engage with your audience. Is it challenging to engage with an audience when the episodes are so long? For example, like, you know, if we put out an episode of Comedy Bang Bang, which is typically an hour, 20-minute show, you know, our comment section gets filled up with people commenting on the podcast. And particularly, they're commenting on certain segments, right? They're like, oh, I loved in minute 25 when this happened. Is it hard when there's so much content in a particular episode to be able to engage with people just because people could have engaged with various elements of the episode?
It's funny because when I think about that, my mind goes to subtly different things. That, I mean, I think you've hit a nerve, but it's a little different than what you're suggesting. I mean, if you do a 4-hour show and someone says, you know, that fact that you said it 2 hours and 13 minutes, mm-hmm. Can you tell me where you got that fact? I mean, I get people who'll start asking for detail
for the bibliography,
footnotes, if you will, for individual things like that. And that's very hard to do when you do these long shows. If I was still doing 20-minute episodes, it'd be a lot easier to say, oh, sure, I'll tell you where to get that. You know, I go online sometimes and it's I told my wife the other day, it's a really sort of surreal experience, at least for me. I think if you're a legitimate celebrity out there, like some, you know, big singer or movie star, you're used to this. But as a podcaster, I'm not used to being able to go online and hit the Google button with my name and watch other people debating me.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do that. They'll say something like, Dan Carlin said this at 3 hours, or they're usually Dan Carlin said this, something I never said, and then say, is he right? And then there'll be a whole big long debate over whether what this guy said I said is true. And it is a strange experience to sit back there and watch people debate the quality of your work, especially when it's about something you never said. I mean, it is interesting, but yeah, I'm not sure that the problem would be any better were we doing shorter shows. I mean, I think you guys probably get it with your shorter shows. People talk about it and get into this or that aspect and debate this or that point. I have a hard time inserting myself into those, though, and answering everyone's questions and that kind of thing.
And so, and you know, you touched upon people questioning whether you were right or where you got your facts. How do you do your research? I mean, I think you told Tim Ferriss that you read 50 books for the World War I series. Is that the type of research that you do? You just try to digest and consume every bit of information you can get your hands on?
Well, and I think this goes back to something we were talking about earlier about the way these things evolve. And I always use the same example, so I'm sorry I'm not more creative in my examples. But I always say, you know, pick your favorite TV series and then go watch the first few episodes of it. And what you'll see is that it's not really the show you've come to like yet. I mean, Seinfeld wasn't Seinfeld in the first five episodes. They're mm-hmm. trying to figure out what they're doing, and things evolve and characters develop and all that kind of stuff happens. So when we started doing this program, the Hardcore History program especially, I had this concept, and the concept was going to be doing a show for people who already know about history, and we were going to talk about all the weird Twilight Zone things that history majors, and I was a history major, used to talk about on their lunch breaks with each other. Mm-hmm. For example, the first show we did is almost a show on a philosophical question. Was Alexander the Great as bad of a person as Adolf Hitler? Mm-hmm. And we were discussing motives and whether or not motives should matter. I mean, if Hitler thought he was creating a better world but had to kill millions and millions and millions of people to get there, does that change him? I mean, if you were sitting on a jury trial for Hitler, and he said, but I wasn't trying to be an evil person. And then you find out Alexander the Great may have killed lots of people to simply, you know, create a more glorious legacy for himself. Does that matter? Mm-hmm. I didn't have an answer, but I love those kind of fascinating questions. And that's what the first show was about. And unexpectedly, people who didn't really know the history started listening and saying things like, well, I love that question, but I really don't have enough background. Mm. And so slowly but surely, we started giving more background so that we could explore those questions. And after a while, you could sort of see that the program needed to incorporate more facts and more narration and more of the story so that we could explore those funky Twilight Zone twists, we call them, that history majors love to discuss amongst themselves. And so I never intended to be reading 50 books or anything like that. And if you actually look at the show notes for each of the shows, you can see how that grew and grew and grew. And eventually, you know, as a person who's not a historian, I have a degree, but that's not a historian, mm-hmm. I felt a real need to make sure that we incorporated multiple views so that, you know, you weren't just getting historian A that Dan Carlin picked, because historians disagree. So I felt this real need to go out there and get multiple views. And surprisingly to me as well, I found that the listeners actually enjoyed hearing how historians disagree about events. Mm-hmm. And so again, that all sort of grew organically in a way. I never would have sat down and said, let me do a show where I have to read 50 books to do a show.
And when you talk about making the show, you say we over and over again. You don't say me. So what kind of production team do you have?
It's possible that I'm using that in the royal sense of the word, you know,
true.
The royal we.
That's right. I want to say thank you to our sponsor, Xero, X-E-R-O. Xero is beautiful accounting software built to help small businesses be more productive and successful. Xero is easy to use. Send invoices, online quotes to your customers, pay your employees, manage your cash flow, expenses, and even your inventory with Xero. Xero is in the cloud, so you can access and manage all of your business and accounting on the go. Xero does what desktop software does and more. Plus, you can use it anywhere at any time from your mobile device. For example, if you've set up shop, Xero can integrate with various point-of-sale solutions and services like PayPal, for example, to save you even more time. Sign up for a free 30-day trial at Xero.com/podcasts. That's Xero.com/podcasts. Xero is beautiful accounting software built to help small businesses be more productive and successful. Sign up today for your free trial. Are you self-employed, an entrepreneur, or business owner who's successful, has good credit, but can't get a mortgage through a traditional lender? Privlo, P-R-I-V-L-O, a new kind of mortgage lender, can help. They take a holistic view of your finances to see if you qualify for a mortgage. Even if you have a bankruptcy or foreclosure over a year old, or a short sale over 6 months ago, you may still be eligible. Same thing if you've avoided taking on debt and have a clean but limited credit history. Privlo knows the gig economy is the new normal and built a company that specializes in home loans tailored to fit real lives. To apply, go to Privlo.com, Privlo.com/podcast, and fill out a simple online form. You'll have a decision in hours. That's Privlo.com/podcast or call 855-477-4850. Privlo. Get home. And now, in an amazing demonstration of compliance, that means Privlo's on the up and up, a few words from the government. Privlo Inc. is a licensed equal housing mortgage lender, NMLS ID 1076413, licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Illinois Residential Mortgage Licensee, Washington CL 1076413, Texas License 107679. So is it just you then producing the show?
It's possible that there's help. We don't talk about that, but you have to have a few little, it's a Santa Claus Easter Bunny kind of question, and I'm not going to crush anybody's views of reality, and you're not going to get me to.
So you might tell me that this is also a Santa Claus question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's amazing to me that you don't work off of a script. I guess I'm curious to know, do you sit there with notes? Do you just kind of go in cold? How does it work?
Well, and that's changed too with the length of the show, because when we started doing the history shows, and this is how I do the Common Sense podcast, where I walk in there and I do it the way we used to do a radio monologue. Initially, I used to think it was cheating to use any kind of editing. And I was worried a little bit, to be honest, about destroying, what a musician would call his chops. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to start to rely on things like editing, because I thought I would lose the ability to do a 15, 20, 30-minute monologue. I think that's a little bit like a muscle, and I wanted to make sure I continually used it. But over time, as the programs got longer, the choice became, do you want to try to start a two-hour show from scratch every time you get 35 minutes into it and you don't like it, or 35 minutes into it and you have to leave, or whatever it might be? So I was convinced to start using editing. And so we do edit the programs now. So what I'll kind of do is go in there, and I usually have references. So for example, for the history show, there might be some quotation on page 236 of this book that I want to make sure I use. And so I'll have a note card or something that says page 236 of this book, and maybe something to remind me what the quote reference is. And whenever I get to that part of the story, I'll pull out that book or what have you. Or if I have a good thought in a take, I'll say, okay, I'll pick this up tomorrow, but make sure you keep that same point you used in there. So there are notes, I guess you could say, but it's not extreme, and there are no scripts. If I did a script, it just would – I don't read scripts all that well. I don't think it would sound all that good. So we don't do that. Does that answer the question?
People always seem so
freaked out by the fact that we don't use scripts.
I'm kind of freaked out by it.
Does it sound like we use scripts?
No, it doesn't sound like you use scripts. It just sounds so seamless and fluid. And I think that you have you just have a unique skill for speaking. It's unbelievable.
I'm not sure. I appreciate the credit, but I'm not sure it's anything you wouldn't encounter in radio amongst a lot of people, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know. I only listen to podcasts.
Well, we used to say when we started podcasting that, not so much anymore, because there's a lot of really professionals in it. But mm-hmm. back when we started, and this is, obviously 2005 is a long time ago in podcast land, but we felt like we had a bit of an advantage over most people, because I think most people at the time were trying to figure out, how to talk correctly into the microphone and do pretty basic things. And we were past that point, luckily. So, I think we started off with a little bit of an advantage. Nowadays, of course, podcasting is filled with some of the most professional voices you'll ever run into.
So that's a good segue into a little bit about the business behind your podcast. I'm curious, I know that you have two podcasts. They both generate revenue. I believe they do. Are they your primary source of income? Would you say that that's your career as a podcaster?
Yes, absolutely. There's really no doubt about that.
That's awesome. And so you have ads in the show, right? I know that you have pre-rolls, but I don't believe you have mid-rolls. Is that right?
We do not do mid-rolls. That's right. And partially because I coming from radio, one of the things I love about podcasting is there's no template. Mm-hmm. Once you put a mid-roll in there, then you have to work around it. And so we didn't want to do that. And we have I suppose you could call it a luxury. It may be a downside if you look at it a different way. we don't need the ads. And so we don't feel any need to compromise. We would not be a good candidate to make much money off advertising anyway, because we get too, if I won't do more than one ad in a program anyway. We get so few shows out that you're basically talking about, you know, two ads a month, maybe. Don't get me wrong. I love the advertisers. I'm glad we have them. But it's a tiny, tiny bit of what we do. And because of the way we do it, it couldn't be anything but. And so we say to the advertisers, listen, it's a take it or leave it deal. I'm not gonna interrupt the show so we can run an ad. The listeners donate to the program. That's how we make a living. So, the ads are kind of a little cherry on top.
And do you go out and kind of do those logistics yourself, or do you have like an ad sales partner?
We have an ad sales partner.
Oh, that's great. And you're not, and so you're never like, are the advertisers trying to tempt you with waving large amounts of money in your face to get to do a pre-roll or a second ad or anything like that?
Well, the other problem I have is that I'm enormously picky about everything, as I guess everybody can see when they hear the work. Maybe obsessive about it might be a better word. And I feel the same way about the ads. I mean, we get people who want us to advertise adult products and alcoholic beverages and everything you can think of, and we don't do any of those. We have like three people we've ever advertised for, and I believe, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but I believe in those particular products. We get good feedback from the listeners, and I have no problem being associated with them, and so it's easy for us. I mean, once we do so few shows that people will buy us out every slot out for the next year and we're done, you know.
That's awesome. And then I know that you're also monetizing by selling archived or older episodes. Is that right?
Yeah, there are two things that first of all, we never intended to make money with this in the first place. The advertising, I mean, all the monetary things sort of evolved with everything else. I think we did the show for several years before we even asked for donations. And so what ends up happening are things come around that you don't expect that turn into ways to make some extra cash. A lot of people know about the Amazon affiliate program, for example, where Amazon will allow you to put a little search window on your website, and they'll give you a piece of the sales if your listeners will use it. Now, it only works if a lot of people do it, but that was nothing we ever planned for, and that's a nice little cherry on top too. The selling of the old shows turned out to be something that a lot of people like. And it's a very difficult thing for us because, you know, as we talk about here internally, you worry about relying on that because, you know, the biggest competitor you have at that point is piracy. Mm-hmm. How do you maintain the integrity of selling the old shows when people can share them and post them and go to pirate sites? And really, so far, our only answer to that has been trust. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the audience wants us to do well, so exactly. Even though they could go perhaps pirate it, they don't. And the other thing we did to try to make that a little easier is we priced the shows really low in the hopes that, you know, it's so cheap, it's not even worth the trouble. It's not even worth the guilt, right? That you would have pirating them. If $1.99 will get you a four-hour show from us, we hope you think that that's money that fairly compensates us for the work we do.
Well, I think that what you touched on is absolutely true, is that people, you're giving the audience so much, you know, high quality content for free that I think that most people probably feel like it's a sense of responsibility to make sure that you get, compensated. And so when it comes to your archived episodes, I think maybe it's not they don't feel a sense of duty, but they feel like they're doing a good thing by supporting you.
I'd like to, because I think it's very interesting in the new media sense. Let me expand upon that a minute, because I still get arguments all the time with people, lawyers, accountants, all these kind of people who say you need to start eliminating giving shows away for free. And I have fought this continually that is a bad idea. And the funny thing is, you know, before we started the donations, we asked, I surveyed a bunch of experts and said, you know, will people donate for this stuff? If we give the shows away for free, will they donate? And I mean, I probably talked to 35 or 40 people, and every single one of them said no. and this is not just us. Obviously, I mean, you know, Radiohead famously put out a song and gave it away for free and asked listeners to pay whatever
they thought
it was worth,
right,
and ended up doing better than they would have done if they were trying to live off what the record company eventually, you know, streamed through to them after they took their cut. Mm-hmm. And this has been the most fascinating and encouraging part of the business, that the listeners do this despite what all the experts thought.
Right.
And here's my problem, is we keep trying to have some sort of a backup plan. You know, what happens in the future if that turns out to be a temporary state of affairs? I mean, I don't know the answer. I'm so enamored with the fact that people are willing to do that, I can't even bring myself to imagine a time when that would stop. I don't want to think about that. We obviously have something that people like. A lot of people say, you know, you could be making a lot more money off this. You know, stop giving it away for free. And I say, well, you know, how does that stop people from going and pirating it?
Right.
I mean, I think we throw ourselves on the mercy of the audience here. And so far, they've not disappointed us at all. It's been a fabulous experience dealing with the new media reality. And it is something that the people in the old media still cannot get their minds around.
Well, I want to talk about new media. You've been podcasting since 2005, right?
Yes.
Is that right? So you're truly one of the medium's pioneers or veterans, at least. How would you?
We didn't think about that at the time, by the way. When I got involved, we thought that there were a few people doing it who were, and I still can't accept that I'm. I mean, I guess because there's been so much time elapsed, you could call us that. But I never thought of us like that. I thought we got into it, you know, not late, but not that early. But now that I look back at it, yeah, 2005 looks like a long time ago.
And have you seen the medium, or how have you seen the medium change in 10 years?
Oh, it's well, you know, for years people were talking about media convergence. You know, the idea that you'd be watching your TV on the computer and mm-hmm. listening to the radio on a device like an iPod. What we have now is convergence, and I always said that what helped podcasts like mine greatly was something that the folks over at Apple with their iTunes decided to do. And I've spoken to them about their decision, and they were very conscious about it. You know, I had said to them that if they had decided a long time ago, when iTunes first started with podcasts, to separate professional content from amateur content, mm-hmm. things would not be the way they are. Instead, they decided to allow you essentially to compete on your merits.
Yeah, meritocracy.
Yeah, putting new media people on the exact same competitive plane with ESPN or NPR or any of those groups. When you look at the top 20 podcasts, the fact that something that I do in my pathetic little home studio is up there with huge media outlets is still mind-bending to me. And I tell the folks over at Apple all the time, you know, I have them to thank for it, because if they had wanted to, they could have put the professional content in a much higher, you know, profile place and shuffled off all the amateur content over into the corner with no average. I mean, you can't even, I mean, I don't know that this is still the case, but for a long time, and as far as I know, you still can't buy an advertisement that puts you at the top of iTunes.
No, I don't think you can. At least.
Yeah, can you?
No, I don't believe you can.
No, and again, that's the same thing. I mean, it keeps the amateur people able to stay in the game and compete with the big boys. And I'm not sure podcasting would have grown and developed the way it had they done it differently. And so, I mean, there's a lot of people that podcasters like myself owe for the fact that this is working at all. And that's one of the examples I always cite as being, I think, key to the growth of the medium.
And have you seen changes even in the past 6 months? I mean, I know here, you know, whether you want to point to things like Serial or Gimlet, our own Wolf Pop Network, I mean, there's been a lot of attention and it seems like a lot of movement in the space. Have you seen that?
Well, it's hard for me to figure out how much of audience, you know, where the audience growth comes from, I guess you could say. We certainly see our own audience growth, but it's tough to figure out if that's because there was some change in the mindset of people out there. Or, I mean, we used to say when some big outlets would start touting podcasts, and they usually would, you know, if ESPN, just to pick on them, if ESPN would say all of a sudden that they're going to rebroadcast their morning show via podcasting and would tell the listeners of the radio program, hey, you know, if you missed it, you can listen to this on a podcast, what they were essentially doing is teaching people how to get podcasts and in effect creating new podcast listeners. Mm-hmm. And so for us, when the professionals would teach their audience to go get the professional content via the podcasting medium, they were creating more potential users that then said, oh, I know how to do this. Oh, are there any other good podcasts out there? Oh, look at this guy, you know, doing the show out of his home studio. And so I think that the, for example, the much publicized effect of the Surreal podcast that the folks over at NPR did, that the publicity from that helps all podcasters. Anybody who all of a sudden reads that and says, I really want to hear that podcast, and takes the short period of time necessary to discover, okay, how do I get a podcast? How do I follow this? That's creating a new audience member for all of us. And so it's hard for me to put my finger on it, but absolutely. I mean, the pool of people that are out there is growing all the time. And I find that rather than a slow growth, you watch the audience levels grow in sort of leaps and bounds. And I can't always put my finger on why that is, but I often think it's because some new outlet somewhere managed to hook a whole bunch of new people up to the podcasting audience grid, if you will.
And in your shows, you know, in your two shows, you've clearly found something that works and is popular. As more and more shows are created, there's more attention on the podcasting space and more content creators come in, do you anticipate people trying to copy your style? It's actually surprising to me that there are so few copycats of the work that you do.
Well, you know, when it comes to copying my style personally, the funny thing about it is the listeners of the show are so enthusiastic and protective, mm-hmm. that they'll out somebody who sounds, I mean, there've been a couple of shows where somebody's tried to use, I mean, my speech patterns are just the way I talk. It's nothing affected. But they'll hear somebody using the speech patterns and boy, you'll see in the reviews on iTunes, people call them out for that. So in a way they protect the proprietary nature of it.
The Carlin
the
Army.
The part that blows me away more has to do with the political show. There are so many political independents out there that I'm amazed that there aren't more political independent podcasts. I mean, I'm amazed that I still have this space, if mm-hmm. you will, kind of to myself. I mean, the Martian political space is still pretty unoccupied. And I find that to be more astounding than people trying to abscond with the history idea. And a lot of times people will come to me and say, listen, you know, I really love your history show. I'd like to do one. Do you mind? Which I think is, talk about beyond being gracious.
That's
those
really,
people
really
are incredibly gracious. And so rather than ripping me off, it's more of a compliment that they're trying to pay me, and they're worried a lot of times that I'll take it personally. So again, maybe that's a new media thing. I mean, maybe the old media will shamelessly rip you off, but a lot of the people who get into podcasting are genuinely worried about how you'll react and don't want to offend you. And so again, maybe I'm just, I always say I'm an evangelist for podcasting. So maybe I'm a little bit of a rose colored glasses view of this whole thing, but no, I don't think people try to rip me off. Influenced and maybe inspired and maybe given good ideas. But listen, we all do that.
I mean, and you know, who
I
influences you?
Nowhere either.
Are there any podcasters out there now or podcasts that you're influenced by or that you listen to regularly?
You know, and I always say this is what always, I mean, I always feel guilty to say no, but it's not because I wouldn't like stuff. It's because I'm primarily a reader. One of the reasons I always was a bad guy for the consultants in radio who would tell me to talk about whatever the latest TV show was that everybody liked to talk about was that I didn't watch them. And so as a media consumer, I'm so old school. I read. And so that's my problem. It's not that there aren't tons of things I would enjoy. I just read. I mean, it's so old-fashioned and boring.
That is very old-fashioned of you.
Yeah, I'm a little guilty. And you know what? One of our great advertisers advertises audiobooks, and I'm ashamed to say I don't listen to those either because I read faster than a narrator would narrate.
Mm-hmm. And so, all right. Well, fair enough. I don't really know what this whole reading thing is that you're talking about, but I
know it's old school.
Take your word for it. So, last question is about the future of your shows and your production. What's in store? Is there a possibility that you'll potentially launch additional shows?
No, if anything, I mean, we sit there and try to figure out how we could do more of what we do already. You know, I've even kind of asked some of the listeners about the political show. Sometimes, you know, we're 280-some shows into the political show. And one of the things that makes podcasting different than radio is that the old podcasts are up there to hear. When we did radio, they used to tell you to hit the same things over and over and over again because people get, you know, stop listening and tune in all the time and the audience is coming and going. And podcasting is almost the exact opposite. Where if you talk about something in a show 3 shows ago and that's still up on your feed, is it really the right thing to do to talk about it again? Mm-hmm. And so when you've done 280 some of these things, I start sitting here wondering if I haven't already expressed all of the major Martian views you might want to hear. I toy with the idea, and I think the listeners might kill me if I say this, but should we be doing 2 Common Sense shows a month? Would that time be better spent on the history show? So I'm almost going in the other direction, wondering if we're not if we shouldn't be focusing more on the new stuff rather than doing things that maybe rather than repeat ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer. And I do feel like if we did anything like that, the reaction would be so negative that we would pay a terrible price for it.
Yeah.
So the one thing we did try to do was And maybe this is in regards to the advice we keep getting about giving content away for free and how we shouldn't be doing that. I tried to tell those people that there is no way to start charging for content that people are accustomed to getting for free without upsetting them. Mm-hmm. What you could do is start offering additional content and that you never gave away for free.
Yep.
And offer that. So we started doing something called extra shows, which to me is a little like, you know, sometimes you'll see a TV show and then afterwards they'll have all of the cast on stage and they'll do, you know, what were you thinking when you developed this character? Sort of a behind the scenes, or yep. Maybe they'll show you deleted scenes or stuff on the cutting room floor. And we always have so much left over in terms of info that doesn't make it into the history show. I thought, well, listen, we'll talk about, you know, extra stuff at the end. We'll never give that away for free. It'll just be a buck or $2. And if you loved the series so much that you don't mind hearing stuff that didn't make it into it, we'll offer that. And so we do these extra shows now as a way of sort of maximizing reading 50 books, right, getting a little exactly. Extra out of it. And the audience seems to be receptive to that. I don't think we could ever charge for the stuff they're accustomed to getting for free. But if you want a little extra and you're willing to pay a buck or two for it, we started offering that.
Absolutely. And then you're not alienating the people who don't want to pay but are still enjoying the free stuff that you're giving
them. We feel like whatever unwritten compact we have with the listeners isn't being violated. Then if they're going to pay for my stuff when they could probably go pirate it, then I feel a responsibility on my part to keep my end of the bargain too.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you coming on. I want to encourage our listeners to go check out. I mean, if you've been to the iTunes store, if you've been in the iTunes chart, it's impossible that you haven't seen these shows because their logos are always there. You'll recognize them the minute you get there. Common Sense and Hardcore History. Dan, where can people, in addition to iTunes, where can they find you or the shows?
You can go to the very hard to remember website address, dancarlin.com, and we ought to have enough stuff there to keep you busy for a little while anyway, for free.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, and thank you, listeners. Subscribe to the show at Earwolf and on iTunes, and please rate and review The Wolf Den. And until next time, happy podcasting. Once again, I want to thank our sponsor, Xero, spelled X-E-R-O. Xero is the online accounting software for your small business. With Xero, it doesn't matter if your small business is brick and mortar or online. That's because Xero was born in the cloud and built in the cloud. This means that you can manage your accounting anytime, anywhere, from your Mac, PC, iOS, or Android device. Sign up for a free 30-day trial at Xero.com/podcast. Don't forget that's Xero.com/podcast to manage your invoicing and get paid faster.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
EarwolfRadio.com. The wolf dead.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Risa Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.